to the new world order. Family sleeping in the car in the southwest. No home, no job, no peace, no rest. Well, the highway is alive tonight, but nobody's kidding nobody about where it goes. I'm sitting down here in the campfire line, searching for the ghost of time travel. He pulls a prayer book out of his sleeping bag. Preacher lights up a buddy and takes a drag. Waiting for when the last shall be first and the first shall be last. In a cardboard box near the underpass, got a one-way ticket to the promised land. Hole in your belly and a gun in your hand. Sleeping on a pillow of solid rock. Breathing in the city aqueduct. But the highway is alive tonight. The way it's hit it, everybody knows.
This is the COVID Noise Filter Podcast on KZFR in Chico. I am the host, Dr. Mark Allen Derry, infectious diseases physician.
And social justice program on KZFR 90.1 FM, Chico, California, every Friday from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m., followed by Playing Dead from 1 to 3. Today on the peace and social justice program, we are going to be talking about the homeless crisis here in Chico, in particular, the latest, quote, sweeping up the camps here. And we have in the studio today and on via Zoom members of the organization known as CFOTS, which stands for Chico Friends on the Street. Before we get into that, I want to say just a couple of things, a couple shout outs. One shout out is to the former general manager of KZFR, Mr. Rick Anderson, who was the GM here for a long time. And I just want to give a shout out to Rick and thank him for all he did for the station, all he did for me personally, getting me on the air, teaching me, and he and Grant Parks teaching me how to do radio. So shout out to you, Rick. Thanks for all your dedication. Also, I'd like to give a shout out to Chris Nelson for getting me back here on the airwaves and doing this program. In case you're wondering who this is Robert Jones. I have hosted this show over the years. I am a professor at Chico State in the philosophy department, and I am also myself a member of, in full disclosure, a member of Chico Friends on the Street. Well, today I have three guests with me. Zooming in, as they say here on the show, is Cicery Sherry. Cicery is a faculty member in the chemistry department and grad student in the education department at Chico State. She is a District 3 Assembly District Election Meeting delegate. Cicery has been involved with Chico Friends on the Street for about a year. She recently started up a breakfast program Cicery, welcome to the Peace and Social Justice Program.
Hi, thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Good to have you. We also have here via Zoom, Jana Burgess Henry. Jana is a retired chemistry and biochemistry instructor from Chico State. She's a former R&D chemist in the pharmaceutical and biotech industries. Jana has been involved with Chico Friends on the Street for, I think, about 3 years now. Jana, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you. Good to be here.
And here in the studio with me is the founder of Chico Friends on the Street, Mr. Patrick Newman, no stranger to these airwaves. Patrick Newman, as I said, is the founder of Chico Friends on the Street, a human rights and civil liberties and homeless advocacy organization here in Chico, California. Patrick, welcome back to the Peace and Social Justice Show.
Yeah, good to be here, Robert. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Well, the first thing I want to kind of lay out there, if we can, for people who are unfamiliar with Chico Friends on the Street, I'd like to start out by saying talking a little bit about who Chico Friends on the Street is or what Chico Friends on the Street does. I'm curious, maybe if we go around and each of us can talk about your experiences with Chico Friends on the Street and also your kind of vision for what the role of Chico Friends on the Street is in Chico with regard to homeless advocacy and human rights issues. So Patrick, do you want to lay out for those people who are tuning in who have no idea what the heck Chico Friends on the Street is? Can you give us a little background?
Sure. About 7 or 8 years ago, I saw the first uptick in what I would call local intolerance for the homeless in a really visible sort of way. And at that point in time, a church group that had been on the plaza for about 10 years was pushed off the plaza, to make a long story short. And they were required to move behind the municipal building where they could do their meal, but they couldn't be seen by the public doing it, essentially. I was appalled by that move, and I wrote a cover story for the News and Review at the time and did about a 5-month protest on that corner. And then there was a bit of a hiatus, and then rolling forward to 2015, our city passed, we passed a sit lie ordinance before that, but that was very narrow and limited. But in 2015, we passed what's called the Offenses Against Public Property Ordinance. Everybody should read that. It's in our municipal code. It's a raft of really vicious anti-homeless laws that are made to criminalize pretty much everything homeless people do in their day-to-day lives. And of course, we could get into what all that's about. But that triggered in me a kind of outrage. I went looking for some uptake on trying to challenge those laws on their face at the time. And so I went to the ACLU here in San Francisco and legal services, talked to a few attorneys around town. I couldn't get any buy off on the idea of challenging these laws on their face, which is, you know, pretty onerous task. And so out of desperation, in January of 2016, I just put a bunch of sandwiches in a bag and went to the plaza and started the first Sunday of distributing what ended up being food, clothing, toiletries, sleeping bags, tarps, and all the things that Friends on the Street brings to the plaza every Sunday. In order to essentially stand with people in the public space in solidarity, to demonstrate an appreciation of their legal right to be in our public spaces, given they aren't housed especially, demonstrate that solidarity and to get to know this population better, to try to build a bridge between the two classes of people, those of us that are housed and those of us that aren't. And then to develop a set of principles and a mission and to understand what our work is. And so that's been an ongoing process over 5 years to really get an understanding of what those human rights principles are, what it means to work in the public space on those principles, what the mission is and what the work looks like. So one last thing on that before I end my ridiculously long monologue here. This question of what we're doing is to focus on the rights of people who are unhoused and not temporarily housed. We're talking about the unsheltered homeless. So there's a line there between sheltered homeless, like someone who's in Torres tonight, and the unsheltered homeless. Those are the people that are pushing the cart at 3 a.m. Our focus as a group is on what kind of civil liberties do those people have? What kind of human rights do they have? And that breaks down into, do they have restroom access? Do they have food and clothing and necessities that they need? Are they being criminalized for their every move? Are they being coerced into some kind of shelter situation that's not appropriate for them? And on the other side, are they being offered choices that are actually good for them? So there's a lot packed into that, but that's as concise as I can make the overall arc of it. So,
and that was the voice of Patrick Newman, the founder of Chico Friends on the Street. Jana Burgess Henry, I want to go over to you because you also have been involved with Chico Friends on the Street for about 3 years now. Can you give us a little background? How did you get involved with Chico Friends on the Street? How did you get involved with issues of the unhoused? How did you come to this? And how did you end up being, you know, standing on, quote, the front lines during the recent sweeps?
Well, about 5 years ago, I decided to try to get more involved in my local community. It was a group of people that lived in my neighborhood region around the Lindo Channel, and they were looking for volunteers to help clean the Lindo Channel. We had a skeleton crew for the parks for many years, and a sort of austerity program, and things were looking pretty ratty in the neighborhood. So I thought, yeah, I'll join in. So I did. And during that process of every Saturday going out for 3 or 4 hours, and going down into the channel, it was pretty apparent how many people were actually living in the channel. And I was a little shocked, to be honest, you know, not people that were not very visible, but there were many, many individuals and small camps throughout the West Lindo Channel area where I live and the East Lindo. And while being involved in this process, this neighborhood group, it varied in number, but it was, you know, 20, 30 maybe at times. And then they had a social media presence as well. And that grew and grew by the hundreds in a fairly short period of time on social media. And there was a rather an alarming just an alarming amount of angry speak, dehumanizing talk about people in the channel, wanting to drive people out. There was talk about using drones and game cameras to flush people out, to know where they were. I was quite taken back by this, and it was really ratcheting up. And there was an awful lot of finger pointing, and it was not too long before that, I mean, after that, that Chico First, that group, that also present on social media, sprung into existence. And not feeling really uncomfortable with where this was going and the way people were talking about maybe getting, you know, concealed carry weapons, this kind of thing, I was really alarmed with this and not aligned with it at all. And I thought, well, I'd like to put my energy elsewhere and in different efforts. And it was around that time that I called, being aware of Patrick and Chico Friends on the Street, I gave him a call and said, hey, can we meet? I'd like to talk about issues around homelessness. You know, they're quite a bit deeper and more systemic. And I wanted to dig a little deeper into this. So we met, and our first conversation was about 3 or 4 hours long. I struck up a friendship with him. I liked what he had to say. And I've been with Chico Friends on the Street since then for 3 years now.
That's great. That is the voice of Jana Burgess Henry, who was a member of Chico Friends on the Street. Let me go over to Cicery Sherry. Cicery, what's your background? How did you come to be kind of on the front lines here with Chico Friends on the Street?
Well, about a year to a year and a half ago, I started going to city council meetings and eventually met Patrick there. We share very similar values, so we ended up speaking speaking on similar things. And eventually he reached out to me online, told me about his program. At first, I didn't really want to go. I'm like, all right, well, I want to support you, but I'm a little shy. It's, you know, kind of an intimidating process. But one day he twisted my arm just enough and I went. And now it's hard not to go. If there's any reason why I can't go one weekend, it doesn't feel good.
And you, when you say go, you're speaking of the weekly Sunday afternoon at noon meetings in the plaza where Chico Friends on the Street meet and hand out, as Patrick said, food and tarps and toiletries and that kind of thing.
That's correct.
Now, Patrick, this effort that you have with Chico Friends on the Street, you're handing out these materials, you're handing out these necessities. Where is the, who's funding you? Where's the funding coming from?
A lot of it is contributed by people who actually purchase things and bring them to the plaza directly. We get donations from people, including yourself, Robert, and others. And they sort of come in here and there. Some people have been extremely generous with us. And so we have a pretty tight budget, but we end up with, I don't know, maybe $10,000 a year in donations, sometimes a little more. And that's a very small budget for a nonprofit. But that all gets turned into all the things that we've been talking about that people need. So it's sort of a cobbled together, you know, it comes out of some of our own pockets. It comes from generous donors. It comes from those of us who just bring things. There's people who donate items to, you know, just drop stuff on my porch. There's some contributions from businesses around town. We had a bakery that was very generous with us for a long time and donated, you know, thousands of dollars worth of baked goods. There's a thrift store in town that donates clothing. So it's really a hodgepodge of sources. I'll just say on that subject of fundraising, I'm not very good at it. And we're also doing something that, as I've looked at the landscape of how government and other, you know, if we talk about local charitable organizations, there's really not a lot of uptake on what we do. There isn't somebody over in Sacramento saying, here's you know, $50,000 to help you supply people on the streets with everything they need. That's just not, and that's an interesting subject in itself. But like when COVID happened and we started with all this, you know, shelter in place stuff, I nosed around and wrote some emails and thought, hey, this is a moment when, look, we're sheltering in place. All these people are in tents. How about, you know, funding some serious support for these camps? Crickets. It's anyway, that's a subject in itself. But there isn't a whole bunch of cash out there for a program like ours. So we do it by hook and by crook, I guess.
That's the voice of Patrick Newman today on the Peace and Social Justice Program. We are discussing the organization here in Chico, Chico Friends on the Street, and we're going to be discussing further the homeless crisis and what Chico Friends on the Street has been doing for at least 5 years now. Before we go a little any further on that, let me let you know that the Peace and Social Justice Program is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. Peace and Social Justice also is supported by Chico Velo, supporting bicycling, education, and advocacy since 1980. The Wildflower returns this year on April 24th with a slightly different twist, a two-week-long extravaganza with three options to participate, special edition merchandise, and virtual interaction along the way. To join the Wildflower adventure, visit wildflowercentury.org and on Facebook. Well, there you go. So if you just tuned in, this is the Peace and Social Justice Program. Today on the program, I have three guests, In the studio, I have Mr. Patrick Newman, the founder of Chico Friends on the Street. And via Zoom, I have two other members of Chico Friends on the Street, Janet Burgess Henry and Sistery Sherry. So, Patrick, you made a reference to the mission of Chico Friends on the Street. And I'm wondering if you can say a little bit about the mission and perhaps how Chico Friends on the Street might be different from, you know, people thinking that relating it to a kind of charity organization or something like that. What's the core, what are the tenets, so to speak, of the core mission of Chico Friends on the Street?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question because like so far we've been talking about this very, very tangible thing. Like you're standing in the plaza and you're handing somebody a pair of socks. Okay, so that's a beautiful thing and that can be done in different ways for different reasons. And it gets into this whole question of charity and justice. And so charity can be practiced with no view toward justice. The more we look at charity and justice in opposition and in harmony, we can see that there's ways that charities can actually abet and support the status quo, make a system that's really dysfunctional and oppressive function better just by virtue of keeping enough stuff sort of flowing toward people that are experiencing oppression and suffering so that we put a kind of band-aid on that suffering, put a band-aid on that fundamental injustice. Another way to approach charity is, you know, like the Black Panthers, when they did their school lunch program for kids, they weren't just supplying food. They had a mission to start to look at questions of justice for people in the community that they served. And so we're not just handing out socks. There's a mission here the mission's very simple. I'll read it. We seek to secure and defend the human rights of those living in our public spaces. So when we look at human rights principles, we can identify what those human rights are. And there's a whole list of those. And then we look at that mission and then we look at, well, what's the work to do that? And so the work isn't just to hand someone a pair of socks. The work is to have the conversations about the kind of injustices that are occurring, to try to, you know, go to city council meetings, to try to represent those human rights, to write letters about those human rights issues, and there's many of them, to come on radio like we're doing today and try to be part of a conversation that leads to a greater awareness of what those rights are and what those injustices are. And so when we do all this work, what we're really trying to do is bring awareness to the fact that, you know, we live in a community where for years and years and years and years, people had no 24-hour toilet access. It's like there's a really fundamental issue right there. Is that a human rights violation? Absolutely. You got people out there who for 8 hours a day don't have one of the most fundamental services that a community can provide. We've got people out there who are systematically deprived of the things they need to survive on the streets, you know, tarps and sleeping bags. We have people out there who are systematically deprived of a right to rest because they're constantly being rousted, incited, and arrested. You have people out there who are experiencing a fundamental human rights violation, which is that they don't have access to shelter in the first place. So as you start to unpack these human rights violations and look at what our role as a community is in those violations, it seems to me it becomes incumbent upon us to see those clearly and to talk about them and to begin to bend the needle toward some kind of consciousness of what justice might look like in a situation like this. And we're not experiencing that in Chico today. So later we're going to talk about that court decision and we're starting to see some notice on that from the outside. But boy, we've been living with the Holocaust. We live with a very violent culture toward people on the streets. So that, you know, that's kind of the if we went through the principles, we could look at those, but that's the mission and that's the work. And there's work to be done.
That's the voice of Patrick Newman, founder of Chico Friends on the Street here on the Peace and Social Justice Program. Janet Burgess Henry, I want to go over to you for a moment. Janet, you mentioned earlier that you had, when you were in your early connections with Chico Friends on the Street via conversations with Patrick, that there seemed to be, you seemed to be simpatico with some of the philosophy, the ideas of Chico Friends in the Street, rather than, as you mentioned, some other groups that were demonizing the homeless. And I'm wondering if you can say more about your vision when it comes to the role that Chico Friends on the Street plays, picking up on this theme of the mission, as opposed to, you know, just showing up and being a charity organization. What are the aspects of Chico Friends on the Street that really attracted you along the lines of, say, justice versus charity?
Yes, well, one of the things that is really attracted to me personally about showing up every Sunday and now also during the breakfast Monday, Wednesday, and Friday is the idea of affirming the right of those who have nowhere else to go or who are living in our public spaces, affirming their right to be there, not to be swept or washed away for this clean, safe Chico that everyone fantasizes about. So I want to be in a public place, getting to know them, sharing. We have laughs, but we also share stories. Getting to know how their day's going, how their week's going, and so I want to be there to do that, to shine a light on it, so that yes, we're visible, we're here, we're sharing time with people. And we're sharing some resources that we can do to make maybe their life just their day just a little bit better, and in their survival, and also as a form of protest. I don't agree with the idea that there should be no services for the poor, or that we just need to put them over on the edge of town, as is always the case that is spoken of. If there was going to be a campground or a sanctioned campground or a low barrier shelter or something of this, that we should, it always needs to be on the edge of town, right? Somewhere over there, somewhere away. And I don't like that idea. I think that we're all part of the community. And I want to get to know people, and I want to share what we have. That's what community does.
Sisteri Sherry, Janet just referred to the morning, the coffee breakfast in a public space. And I understand that you are spearheading this activity with Chico Friends on the Street. I'm wondering if you could talk more about that and what your role is in that movement.
Sure. Well, this is partially in response to the Jesus Center closing. Somebody's got to serve breakfast, right? Somebody's got to, everyone needs their coffee. I spent a good many years serving coffee for a living, and there is a really unique look of joy on someone's face when they take that first sip, regardless of who they are. And so I thought it would be good to have a breakfast program, not just to feed people so they can survive, but to give someone that brief moment of joy when they have really no opportunity otherwise to experience pleasure.
When are you out there? When do you meet? When are you distributing the coffee and the breakfast? And where?
It's same place as on Sundays, on the southwest corner of the downtown plaza. It's on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 9 to 10 a.m.
So every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 9 to 10 a.m., any and everyone who is there, if they so desire, can partake of a nice hot cup of coffee and some pastries or muffins or whatever you have there to offer.
Absolutely.
Wow. And now, Patrick, Sisteri did mention the closing of the Jesus Center. Can you say a few words about the closing of the Jesus Center?
Yeah. So when management changed at the Jesus Center 5 years ago, and we lost the services of Bill Such, who's a really amazing person who I love a lot, a shift was made toward moving away from what I would call radical hospitality and no barrier services to more and more of an atmosphere of higher barriers. And then ultimately in 2017, there was a memorandum of understanding between the Jesus Center and the city of Chico to relocate the Jesus Center to a point of intake center, consolidation center. It's called Consolidation of Services. And that was originally slated to go over there behind Torres, kind of near Costco. That fell through, but the relocation happened. And now, instead of offering no barrier access to food and clothing, which was fundamental to the original mission of the Jesus Center, it's being transformed into a high barrier program for people who want to live there and go through some kind of training process. And so it's called the Renewal Center and various other things. But it's been specifically described, when I say high barrier, I mean people who have already jumped through a few hoops and proven that they can, let's just say proven in quotes, that they can be take advantage of a program like that. And in my, just to put it bluntly, to be fixed. And I don't look at poverty that way at all. I don't think that because someone's poor, that we're in a position to decide that they need to be fixed. I believe in radical hospitality. And we've lost our only soup kitchen in a city of 100,000 people. And that happened by design. It wasn't just accidental. It was planned over many years. And that was the dream of what Bill Such would call the property class. And so they never wanted a no barrier soup kitchen or no barrier source of food and clothing in Chico. And so they were delighted to have it go away. Anyway, that leaves us in a situation where, as Cicery said, we have hundreds and hundreds of people on the streets who struggle to get food, and they'll have a harder time doing that. And so I think trying to close that gap a little bit in any way we can, and create more distribution hubs where people can get their material needs met, is a really good thing to do. And just to interject again real quickly here, deprivation is a human rights issue. Deprivation goes to the heart of whether or not a person has agency and liberty. Because if you use engineered deprivation, you can manipulate people with that. You can coerce people. In the Robert Marbut model, who's the sort of the guru of consolidation containment thinking on homelessness, you remove all availability in the public space for any sort of materials that people might need, and then now you have a way to wedge them or leverage them into whatever program you want to put them in, whether it's something they want, whether it's good for them or not. It gets them out of the public space, and now you're hiding the homeless, and that's something that a lot of people desire to do. Anyway, so yeah, there's a lot more to that history, but that was, probably.
Thanks, Ben.
Yeah,
there's a lot to talk about with that. Let me let our listeners know that they are tuned into KZFR 90.1 FM. This is the Peace and Social Justice Program. I'm your host today, Robert Jones. I have in the studio with me Mr. Patrick Newman, who is the founder of Chico Friends on the Street. And via Zoom, I have two members of Chico Friends on the Street, Janet Burgess Henry and Cicery Sherry. And we are discussing the crisis here in Chico and the ways to ameliorate the oppression, if you will, of one of the most demonized class of people, those unhoused. Now, I want to bring something up. I want to, Patrick, if you and if all three of you actually, Cicery and Jana and Patrick, if you could speak to the following thing, and that is, I'm going to present four terms that, Patrick, I've heard you speak about already today, a couple of them, and that is criminalization, demonization, containment, and what was your fourth D?
Deprivation.
Yes, deprivation. So you have demonization, you have deprivation, you have criminalization, and you have containment. And can you speak to, for someone who's listening to this program, someone who's driving their car, they pop on KZFR, they're hearing people talk about homeless folk in Chico, they're thinking, oh yeah, the Jesus Center or the Torres, there's people that take care of them. Can you say a little bit about this? It's a bigger strategy. And as you mentioned, Patrick Newman, this is a strategy that comes straight out of the book of Robert Marbut, who is, I would say, notorious anti-homeless, quote, advocate. If you could say something about this general method of the demonization and detainment and criminalization and containment. Talk a little bit about, and all three of you, I'd like to hear what you have to say, but talk a little bit about how does this work? What are we talking about? And what is the function of these four actions? What's the plan when you implement these four kinds of behaviors that are instituted by the state? What's the big picture here? Let people see what's going on from you know, zooming out a little bit.
So if once you have an absolute certainty that there will be a number of people unhoused because you have more people than housing, you have a contest or a competition where someone will lose. And we know who loses. The people who have the brain injuries lose, the people who have mental illness lose, people who have addiction issues lose, people with traumas of all kinds lose, people that have circumstances beyond their control where life spins out and they lose, you know, some series of catastrophes happen. People who have experienced the trauma of intergenerational poverty and have high ACE scores, those are the people who lose in the competition for housing. Now we're down the rabbit hole. Okay, how do we as a society respond to that? Do we respond to it by addressing that fundamental injustice that's there? Because we're really talking about poverty. We're really talking about resource distribution. Or do we start looking at this through this lens of blaming and identifying the people as the problem versus the problem as the problem? So once you start to identify the people as the problem, you can demonize and scapegoat those people, and you can create a kind of culture of disdain and disgust, and you can use that to drive policy. Okay, what kind of policy do you drive? You drive criminalization policy, and you make this kind of poverty a law enforcement issue. And there's a lot of people in town who believe that you can just enforce the law. These people aren't poor, they're lawbreakers. So what you do is you take this hammer called the criminal justice system and you hammer on them with that. The other thing you can do is you can deprive them, like we just talked about a minute ago, and you can use deprivation to manipulate people. You can hide them by using deprivation. You can take away their fundamental liberties by using deprivation. And the fourth part of that is, if you really want them out of sight somewhere, you warehouse them. And so you put them into what they call transitional housing programs, or they're transitions to nowhere. There's if you don't have enough housing, and you put people into large congregate, you know, shelter facilities, and they languish there. What you've done is you've just reinstitutionalized a whole bunch of people who, you know, we had institutionalized a long time ago, and then failed to follow through with supporting them in the community when they were deinstitutionalized. So you're back to square one, only you've done it for 10 cents on the dollar. And it's an effective way to get people out of sight and out of mind. But containment, when we talk about beds, we ought to be really careful to think about what we're talking about. Because just because you have a bed for somebody doesn't mean that you're responding humanely to what's going on with them. You don't have a house for them, you have a bed. So those elements are what I would say a pathological response to poverty. And we see elements, many elements within each of those play out. Anyway, that's kind of the overall rundown on that.
Well, Patrick Newman, I'm sure you would agree that this strategy of that you described, the four aspects of the strategy, this is nothing new. Historically, going way back at least to the 16th century in England, we have the criminalization, the demonization of poverty. And if you look, looking in the uglier aspects of the history of the United States and in Europe, we see things like massive oppression, or we see civil rights violations, we see the Holocaust. And this is it's a very familiar strategy. I want to circle back, Jana, to something you were saying earlier about when you started to contribute to your community through doing cleanups, you noticed that there was a kind of, if correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like you were noticing that there was this demonization narrative of the homeless. I'm wondering if you can say more about your experience with these aspects of anti-homeless culture.
Something Patrick said really rang true with me, that I was noticing the talk amongst the volunteers and those in the social media groups involved in cleanups, that there was this idea that it's the people that are the problem, the individual, the failure of individuals is why they are poor or living in the public space. And this was a really common theme, and that it was important. And many were talking as though because they've made poor choices in life, this is why they're in this situation. There was a lot. Oh, well, one of the things that came up, a lot of arguments, because I was getting involved with friends on the street at one point where I was even being demonized. You are part of the problem, Jana. You and your friends are supplying things to people. So this idea of feeding the bears has come up. You know, if you just deprive people of things, don't contribute to the mess. Don't contribute to them wanting to live the way they're living, as though it was just a want, a need, as opposed to a need. So there was a lot of anger around these issues. You should not be giving people things so that they will go to a center, so they will go, you know, be so deprived that they will go somewhere else, or hopefully is what many people think, or if they're going to still be here, that they will go into a center and seek some help, that there should be no one else giving them any kind of hand. So that was a really common thing. That, as well as a lot of discussion that people that within those volunteer groups, that we should be calling into the police at every opportunity. Let them know there are people doing things they don't like. There are people living somewhere they don't like. So the flood of calls to the police department, and it was a rather coordinated effort to have lots of police calls, have them all logged in so that it's clear that they're angry and they want people gone.
And this is the strategy of demonizing and, of course, criminalizing. Cicely Sherry, I'm wondering if you have experience with maybe tension, or I mean, this is what you're doing is you're putting yourself, perhaps your reputation, perhaps even your social circle at risk. And I'm wondering, what are your experiences with this, these aspects of interacting with folks? Maybe it could be folks you love, folks who are your friends, colleagues who buy into this demonization narrative. Have you had experience with that? And how do you deal with that?
I'm pretty lucky. All my friends are very supportive of what I'm doing. Now, there's a caveat of me not having much of a social life at all, so there's not much opportunity to receive a lot of hate from people. And that's probably for the best. But I did have some neighbors who just for context, I live very close to where the Jesus Center used to be. So there are actually quite a lot of unhoused in my neighborhood. And we had a couple move in down the street who were the type of person who would be angry at the sight of homeless people. And we had a somewhat politely tense relationship. But then fairly quickly they moved out. So lucky me again. But although I don't know the people who just moved in, so who knows, it could be worse. But now I'm fairly lucky. I intentionally stay off of the social media sites that are full of haters. Those, you know, I have no problem with reading about things I disagree with, but when it comes to all the vitriol and incitement of violence goes, that just makes me angrier than I need to be.
Well, like your neighbors you mentioned who get angry at the sight of homeless people. I too get angry at the sight of homeless people, but I have a feeling it's for a different reason. My anger is more of moral outrage and righteous indignation against a system that criminalizes and demonizes poverty and things like mental illness and addiction. And so when I see a homeless person, I do get angry on behalf of them against what I see as an unjust system. Well, before we continue on, let me just let people know that you are listening to the Peace and Social Justice Program on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico, the Zephyr. I need to let you know just a couple things here. The Peace and Social Justice Program is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the regional and continuing education Center at Chico State. Regional and continuing education offering online graduate test preparation courses for those seeking an advanced degree in a wide range of fields, including law and business. So just sign up for a complimentary strategy session to help you prepare to take the GRE, the GMAT, the LSAT. Do that over at rce.csuchico.edu. That's rce.csuchico.edu. And by Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family-owned, operated, and argued over since 1980, reminding listeners to think for themselves, but drink with others. I'd like also to let you know that if you enjoy this program, you can now go to kzfr.org and tip the show. If you're not enjoying the program and you're angered by it, you can tip the show. We'll accept tips from anyone, whether you like it or not. Tip the show, please. kzfr.org, that's where you go. So I wanted to pick up on a couple of things. I want to talk a little bit about the history that has led up to the recent sweeps. I hold in my hand here, Tuesday, April 27th, 2021 issue of the Enterprise Record, the Chico Enterprise Record. And right there on the front page is a photograph of Mr. Patrick Newman holding a sign says, thank you, LSNC, which is the Legal Services of Northern California. Patrick, we're going to get to this and how you got on the front page of the ER. Usually, I think the ER puts you in the wanted list, but somehow you made it onto the... But anyway, I want to raise an objection before we move any further. I want to raise a common objection, and I want to hear what the response is. So look, here's what I'm hearing from what's been discussed here on this program so far, and that is you have these people who are the victims of a system that, well, invariably, if it's a mathematical certainty, it's a game of numbers. You have a certain amount of available housing units, and you have a certain population, and the population exceeds the available housing units. So just mathematically, as an empirical fact, you're going to have people who are unhoused. Okay, fine, we get that. However, this notion that you have this big bad system and it's really bad to the people, here's a common objection, and that is, look, these people made decisions in their lives and they ended up where they are. So when I walk down the street and I'm going to go downtown to buy something and there's a homeless person there and it's really annoying and perhaps they're talking to themselves or they don't look clean and I have to walk past them. I feel uncomfortable. I feel in danger, my family, right? And so these people are there on the street because they made certain choices, right? There's even the latest myth that I've been hearing is that these people, what they love to be on the street. They just choose to be on the street. They want to. That's how they want to live their lives. Mm. So, but here's the objection I want you to answer, because I think a lot of people, and I even people on the left, when I say the left, I'm, you know, left of center, not necessarily progressive, but people think, look, you know, hey, I don't want to live in a town with homeless people. I want to walk downtown. I want it to be clean. I want to be able to go to the store. I don't want to see all these homeless people around. And then for you to come along with Chico Friends on the Street, they congregate at the plaza. You hand out these things, these tarps. You're enabling these people. You're telling them it's okay to be living on the street. And what you're doing is you're exacerbating the problem and you're taking away the responsibility of these people for their lives. Even Patrick, you argue at the foundation that what your work is a respect of human rights, right? And this kind of these liberties to choose to go live where you so desire. So why don't we just say, look, these people are living how they want to live and they made these choices and they're impinging on the lives of the rest of us. And so instead of enabling them, why don't you just get on board and help us get them somewhere where they can be taken off the street and, you know, cared for somewhere on the outskirts of town or something like that. And that way the rest of us can be, you know, live in a nice community without all this defecation and all this stuff. So, Patrick, let me put that to you, because I have a feeling you've heard this objection before. What do you say to those people? That's I'm going to say a vast majority of people have that kind of a view.
Let's see. Robert, that was so well stated. I think I'm just going to quit and go home. You really did a good job of laying that out. So to unpack that. Okay. So as you said at the beginning, there's a mathematical certainty that somebody will be unhoused when you don't have enough housing units. Okay. So, and you know, we can look at who those people are. So when you see that person sitting out in front of a grocery store or something, I talk often about the Toronto study where they took men off the streets at random, put them through an MRI machine and did a neurological workup, and slightly over 40% of the men had traumatic brain injuries, and about 85% of those injuries happened before they were homeless. So when you look at a homeless population, you're talking about men on the streets, you can guess that many, many, many of them have traumatic brain injuries. Look at the homeless population, and you can bet that many of those people have serious mental illness issues. You can bet that they have a history of trauma of some kind. So with the mathematical certainty that someone will be unhoused, then there's going to be people out there. Okay, so the whole question of making a choice to live in this kind of destitution, life circumstances of being born into intergenerational poverty and having, you know, trauma in childhood, all these kinds of things, very few people on the streets had some choice to make about this. They're living on the receiving end of a housing deficit. They're living on the receiving end of a very poor distribution of resources. We have over twice as many square feet per capita, residential square feet per capita, than we had in the 1950s in the United States. So we build plenty of square footage. We don't distribute it very well. So why not just get on board and say, hey, I'm going to deprive you of the most basic things. Like tonight, I'm not going to give you a sleeping bag. We spend a lot of money on sleeping bags every winter. If I don't give you a sleeping bag, you brain-injured man who was once a carpenter and a rack of pipes fell on your head, somehow by not giving you that sleeping bag today, that's going to somehow be instrumental in getting you to fix your life. That's kind of the argument, I think, here. What's wrong with that argument? Well, what happens is that person is now on the streets without a sleeping bag tonight. And people die because of exposure. So we're talking about grinding people down with a kind of poverty that's just the absolute worst kind of poverty, which is being on the street unhoused without even the most basic necessities. Okay, so now if you made the argument that by not giving them that sleeping bag, they would be driven somewhere, where's the somewhere? Well, do they have a choice? Let's say that we open a congregate shelter of the sort that Robert Marbut advises, which I have a hunch we're on our way to doing that right now in Chico, a Joe Arpaio style camp, you know, somewhere out by the airport. And by not giving that man a sleeping bag, he now must go there because otherwise he's going to freeze to death when it's 25 degrees at night or whatever, or just be so miserable that he must go there. And then, so now by not giving him the sleeping bag, I'm saying to this person, look it, I'm not going to help you right now. The way I'm going to help you is I'm not going to give you anything. And then somehow you're going to end up out there at this congregate shelter by the airport, but it's not going to be because you chose to go there. And it's not going to be because that place is a place you were drawn to because you, given your agency and your liberty, saw that as a better thing to do than to be out on the street. You're going to go there because you have to go there, because if you don't, you're going to die. Well, now I've just incarcerated somebody by virtue of deprivation. I've used deprivation to get them out there. That's, to me, that's not, and now that they're there, what happens next when you don't have any housing? Well, you've got this person warehoused out there against their will because they didn't make a free choice, obviously. So and there's nothing in that containment facility out there at the airport that's going to solve the shelter crisis problem. It's not going to create more affordable housing for people. It's not going to create services for people. What it does is it just pushes this person into containment. And that's all wonderful from the point of view of someone who says, I just don't want to see this kind of poverty. But why don't we look at it through the eyes of the person who's out on the street and ask the question, like what, how much integrity is there in a process like that? How does that look from the point of view of justice or respect for that person, respect for that person's, you know, free will, agency, choice, all those kinds of things. So there's a whole, I mean, that argument that just by depriving people, we can fix them. It's very simplistic. It's very formulaic. And it doesn't really cut to the chase of who these people are. And I think one of the things that's missing when people make that argument is direct knowledge of who they're talking about. And if more of the people who make that argument would actually open themselves up to the kind of discomfort that we experience when we actually get to know people on the streets better, they would see that their formulas fall apart. And so this is where the suffering that is out there on the streets and very visible, and the closer you get to it, the more information you get about it. That information is something that informs us on a moral level, but also on a practical level about how well those formulas hold up. So anyway, you did such a masterful job of making the argument that I'm not sure I made the best possible counter argument, but maybe Cicery and Jana can help me out.
Cicery or Jana, do you want to jump in and comment on this?
Let's say for a second it is their choice. Does that mean they don't have any moral worth? So we have all these houses because people want to theoretically live in houses. And so we build infrastructure around that. But if you say had a population that wanted to live a nomadic lifestyle, as they say, why do we punish that instead of building infrastructure for that? Like why is that something that's wrong? I mean, maybe you might say, well, because they don't have any money, they're not paying their way. That comes in with the issue of poverty. But just thinking about, okay, maybe they made a choice. What bad choice could possibly be worth the punishment of that level of deprivation? It's like, oh, they chose to use drugs. Well, I mean, yeah, no, that of course that's not good, but does that really mean you should torture someone like that? It doesn't really make sense.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's another aspect of this is how much of life circumstance, how much involves things like chance and things that are out of our control. How many people who are listening to my voice right now can honestly say that in their lifetime, they have never done anything like use illicit drugs, use contraband, drive home when they were, maybe a little bit tipsy, a little bit over the 0.08, right? So, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. How many times have we sort of slipped by and by chance made it home or not gotten caught or not gotten pulled over? So there are many of us who have made similar, quote, choices and yet didn't end up in the criminal justice system. And if you end up in the criminal justice system, then of course you, it's a spiral often from there to a difficult life. Let me just remind you, you're listening to KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico, and this is the Peace and Social Justice Program. I have Patrick Newman in the studio with me, the founder of Chico Friends on the Street, and I have two members of Chico Friends on the Street, Cicery and Jana. And I want to, when we get back on the other side of this short little break, Jana, I was wondering if you could do us a favor and give us a little brief rundown, because through, say, the past year, there have been various anti-homeless actions taken by the city leading to sweeps at the Triangle. I'm wondering if we can move into a discussion about that. Give us a brief history. And then I want to talk about the recent case, which is a cease and desist order filed on behalf of the plaintiffs, the homeless plaintiffs against the city. So let's try to circle back to all of that in just a moment, right after this brief break.
Hi, this is Ray Lager, Underwriting Director at KZFR. In these uncertain times, one thing is for certain. You have to reach out to inform the public of any changes in your business or organization. If you'd like to be represented to our thousands of weekly listeners, please contact me at underwrite@kzfr.org or call or text me at 520-4742. That's 520-4742. I'd love to share some information about how KZFR can help you in these trying times. Please stay safe, and together we will grow a more compassionate community.
You're listening to the Peace and Social Justice Program on KZFR 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Robert Jones. And we have in the studio with me here, I have Patrick Newman of Chico Friends on the Street. Via Zoom, the wonders of technology, the wonders of computers, we have Cicerie Sherry, who was also a member of Chico Friends on the Street, and Jana Burgess Henry as well. Now, Jana, before we had that little break, I'd ask you if you would do us a favor and sort of outline the kind of watershed moments, the low points, if you will, of the city's response to the housing crisis. Can you give us a little history and your experience with that, and culminating with the events that took place at the sweeps, particularly at the Triangle? Can you recount that for our listeners?
Sure. Over the past, about a year ago, right? So we were heading into the pandemic in March. And sometime in March, I think the latter part of where the CDC and our Governor Newsom had said, well, we should have a shelter in place. We need to get this under control. And at that time, it was considered for those that were without homes, those living on the street, that they should shelter in place. And our governor said that he would make allowances for that. So identifying properties, et cetera, to allow people to stay safely, hopefully, where they were, as opposed to just trying to seek other shelters, many of which were partially shutting down. And that is sort of the backdrop to what would ensue before too long in Chico, where in the early April, the city council did, in fact, say that, yes, we agree with this shelter in place. We will not have the Chico Police Department moving people out of camps, that they should remain where they are. And that was voted in. But then pandemic didn't ease up much. I think people were hoping that it would be a very short period of time before, and this goes on all summer, and come late August, the city council decided, well, let's rescind that shelter in place order. That's no longer going to be happening. Turn around October-ish, so a month and a half later, perhaps, there was brought up before the city council that the park and playground rules should be increased in criminalization for any infractions, which that used to just be an infraction or a warning for a number of rules and regulations in our parks. And we were going to bring those into the Chico Municipal Code and allow them to any infractions to now become enforceable misdemeanors. This was postponed, I think, up to three times. It was not from early October all the way to December 8th, where the new council was sworn in, conservative sweep of the council. And immediately, their first action, their first night on the council, they brought forward this urgency ordinance for the park and playground regulations. And it was read and voted in, passing 5-2 to increase criminalization of the parks, playgrounds, greenways, and waterways. A short break, Christmas. I think there's not very many meetings in December, but come early January of this year, of 2021, there was eviction notices at Lower Bidwell Park. That was January 12th, right around in there. Annie's Glen area and the Horseshoe Pit camps, there were camps there. They had been given 72-hour notices the previous week, so probably first week of January. There were some weather delays, et cetera. And then on the 12th, the city crews came in and the road was closed there at Lower Park. And they came in and removed all campers. A lot of people gathered to protest. At that point, the news showed up. There was a lot of people hanging out and observing, witnessing. I found myself feeling very helpless and useless. I was mostly there observing, being someone who could document. I took a lot of pictures. I talked to a lot of the campers. And at one point, it was so disturbing to see people's belongings trashed, picked up by big grabbers and thrown in dumpsters. They brought equipment in to flatten out the area where people had been camping, seeing people scattering. There had probably been, at one point, maybe 70 tents there. At one point, I walked off after a young man thanked me. He said, "Thank you for being here, because things wouldn't have gone as well if you all hadn't been here." And I thought to myself, oh, Lord. I just sort of walked off to the side and started to cry. It was heartbreaking. So a number of us in Chico Friends on the Street, even after this sweep of the camp, a number of us stayed and protested out in front of Lower Bidwell Park for another 3 days. And we're discussing what we had witnessed, how we felt about it. None of us felt very good about what happened. So it was not until about the latter part of January, I think it was around the 21st, there was another 72-hour eviction notice at a place known as the Triangle. There were a number of campers, maybe again about 70-some, I think, at one point in time, 70-some tents. And this triangle is bordered a triangular area between busy streets bordered by pine and cypress and Humboldt Avenue. So it's a triangular bit in there, considered a greenway. Little Chico Creek flows through part of it. Well, they had received notice. Again, there were many delays. This area was eventually, it wasn't until February 4th that this area was eventually completely evicted. During that time, so January 21st, 22nd, right around in there, all the way to February 4th, there were a handful or so of people from Chico Friends on the Street and some of our other community members that held vigil every day from 8 until roughly noon, sometimes longer, in protest, in letting people know this is what's going to be happening. These people are going to be removed. There is nowhere for anyone to go. It's still midwinter. We've had a lot of bad weather. It's still a pandemic. And what the heck? What's going on? And so that sort of brings me up to, that's where we were at the Triangle. A lot of people came in when the maintenance crews and the Chico Police Department and park rangers came in to move people out and cordon off the area. A number of community members came in and sort of with trucks and U-Hauls, et cetera, and sort of rescued people, helped them gather some belongings that they could and move them to other parts of town. But so that's kind of the layout.
That's the voice of Janet Burgess Henry, and she is a member of Chico Friends on the Street. And you are sharing with us the kind of watershed events that have been occurring, particularly leading up to the February 4th sweep, the removal of the encampment at the Triangle. The way you describe it, it sounds like a tragic and really heartbreaking event that day in the history of our city. Cicery, I'm wondering, did you stand in solidarity with the homeless at the Triangle as well? Were you there? Were you a part of that vigil?
I was there, although not nearly as many hours as Patrick and Jana. But I was able to show up for a few days in addition to my partner, Andrew, and be able to talk with some folks there and stand with a sign.
And that experience, would you echo that it was kind of helpless? Did you feel helpless and powerless?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't do anything. It was an unstoppable force. No, I might as well have been an ant.
Patrick Newman, can you give us your insights? Can you relate some of your experiences regarding the tragic sweep of the Triangle, and maybe speak to a little bit about the lack of just physical bodies who showed up in support of the encampment?
Sure. So one of the dreams that has always gone along with, you know, being on the plaza, you know, for 5 years and showing up at council meetings, trying to communicate human rights principles, has been to try to get critical mass in this community to really have, you know, a functional voice with, you know, as many members as possible to develop, you know, a cohesive force to stand in these moments when they occur. What happens in Chico is we have episodic interest in this stuff when there's some drama around it. Typically, I'm sorry to say it, but that's what happens. Consistent, you know, really committed focus on human rights and understanding them and developing a group that's cohesive. And I think that's the practice on Sunday. That's how I've always seen it, is as a place to make that happen. We did a little protest after the clearing of Bidwell. We stood out there for a few days. And then, I mean, my dream, and I think our dream, at least fatuous though it may be, was to go from Bidwell to the Triangle and build numbers. So we had multiple 72-hour notices on the Triangle. We had 12 full days to build critical mass. So in my dream world, parallel reality, there could have every day been twice as many people out there, and we could have built the numbers up to, you know, out of a city of 100,000 people, 1% could have shown up, and that would have been 1,000 people to stand on that triangle and make a very different kind of statement. In fact, what we had was, you know, 5 or 6 of us showing up. So going from the triangle to the next sweep, and there's been several along the way, we could have also built numbers, but I think all of us left the triangle feeling really discouraged. I know I did. And it was hard to know what to do next. And then it was a question of, well, okay, we've got, you know, more sweeps coming. And I know that there was some rescuing done. People were picked up and moved, and there's, you know, that's a complicated issue, but not a bad thing, but it's not a community standing in defense of the camps, which Jana and I actually tried to generate some interest for last summer. We poked around with some of the leftist organizations and tried to get some uptake on, hey, this is coming. Can we build some kind of organization to defend these camps when the time comes? So, you know, going forward to what's the out of the areas that were swept. So it was Bidwell Park, then the Triangle, then what's called Windchime Park. And then the next one on the chopping block was Comanche Creek Greenway. That's the camp that's still intact. It's still occupied. There's probably 100 people living there. And, you know, going right up to the present almost, that camp, as of about, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, you guys, but it was about a week ago, or a little over a week and a half ago. That camp had a couple of 72-hour notices, and the day before that camp was going to be swept, we still didn't have numbers to stand there. And it was just a matter of showing up on a Monday and watching the police sweep that camp, rescuing a few people, a few of us standing in opposition, but no critical mass. So what saved Comanche Creek Greenway camp was the fact that a judge on a Sunday afternoon responded to the Legal Services of Northern California request for a temporary restraining order. And that brings us up pretty close to today. So packed into that temporary restraining order and the court hearing that happened last Friday, there's a whole lot of information about where Chico has gone off the rails. And that's something I hope we can all address. And Jenna, you know, I'd like you to, if you have that quote from the judge handy, I'd like you to read that. But, well, maybe I haven't filled that out quite well enough yet.
Let me, before we do that, I do want to go to Janet in just a moment. And that's the voice of Patrick Newman, founder of Chico Friends on the Street. I need to let you know that the Peace and Social Justice Program is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Quicksilver Courier Service, established in 2010. Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services. Quicksilver provides courier service for private individuals as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. And by Joe Schultz, attorney at law, solving legal problems since 1972. Experienced in personal injury law, as well as trust administration, estate planning, wills, real estate, and probate law. For questions about estate planning or a personal injury case, Joe Schultz can be reached at 530-413-9885 and by email at joe@joeschultzlaw.com. Well, Janet Burgess Henry, can you, Patrick Newman just mentioned this restraining order. I was wondering if you can bring us up to date and give us some insight into what the judge's response was to the city of Chico.
Yeah, one thing that really stood out when I did listen in on the call during the court proceedings the other day and then reading through the transcript, one thing really stood out to me when Judge England said that he and four law clerks had pored over the ordinances of Chico, an anti-camping ordinance, the personal property ordinance, the sit-lie ordinance, and offenses against public property ordinances. And he then said that they were broad and general and quite the web. But to quote him, at one point he says, if you take repeat these ordinances all together, a person could never sit, sleep, lie, or obtain shelter on any property, or else they would be criminally prosecuted according to these ordinances when you read them, unless the person was walking 24 hours a day and had no personal property, end quote. So that's quite the quandary. I'm really curious as to how this will end up. As the court left, the city legal services of Northern California and the city were to be in, have 3 weeks to discuss the problems that existed on both sides with this lawsuit. And the judge wanted to hear more about it, but there was no ruling, of course, on what the city would be doing with these ordinances. It's in their hands at this point.
So the legal services of Northern California brought this restraining order, and Judge England issued this opinion, or I don't know if it's technically an opinion, but it sounds pretty clear that this judge, who I believe is a conservative Bush appointee, yeah, this judge pretty much flatly stated that these criminalization laws can't hold up in court. I don't know if they're necessarily violating any constitutional rights. I don't know if he went that far, but it sounds to me like the city of Chico is being called out by this restraining order. And I'm wondering, I don't know, maybe I'm a naive optimist, who knows, but will there be some positive change in the city that may come from this?
Wow. Yeah, that's anyone's guess. I suppose in part it will depend on what the city and legal services come up with as potential solutions to this dilemma. The judge did say that the city of Chico is running afoul of the Eighth Amendment and potentially due process for personal property. So he said, nobody will be happy if I make a decision today. So I'm leaving it up to you to come back to me with what we're going to do about this. I have no idea. The city rewriting their ordinances by themselves without being ordered to do so, hard to imagine.
Cicely, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I'm not super optimistic. I think it was Calvin that said a good compromise leaves everyone mad. we'll have to see. I'm not optimistic that legal services and the city are going to be able to come to any sort of agreement, especially since the council is not even willing to talk about it at this point still.
This brings us right back to your photograph on the cover of the Enterprise Record from the 27th, Patrick, holding a sign saying, "Thank you, Legal Services of Northern California."
Yeah. So, I mean, that has been my dream since 2015, is that we would get litigation on these ordinances. So, I mean, there's shelter, and then there's criminalization law and our obstruction of shelter alternatives, for one thing. But there's kind of like two different issues, but they go together, of course, because you use criminalization and then you obstruct any sort of project to do a campground or tiny house village or anything that might, you know, provide some shelter relief for people. So that's been those have been our city practices for a long time. So where this comes to today from my point of view is given my knowledge of who our city attorney is now, who our city manager is now, who's on our city council now, and having watched them carefully and closely for, you know, 6 to 7 years, because the same city attorney we have now is the one who wrote the offenses against public property ordinance. It's a cutting edge criminalization law. My fear is that given who our city staff is and who our city council is, that what they will try to do is hang on to as much of this criminalization law as they can, and they will give the court the absolute minimum to get the court off their backs, which would be to go back to a plan that was floated by Mark Orem last fall, which is to put some kind of a high density congregate shelter out at the airport somewhere on what's, you know, some kind of tarmac area. That would probably be the best case scenario from the point of view of people who want to offer the least to the poorest people. And that is exactly what they say they want to do, because they've been very clear about that. Sean Morgan said, you know, and many times that, you know, if you eliminate services, you can eliminate these people. So my fear is that is what they will try to do. Whether the court will allow them to get away with that, that's hard to say. But I know where they're going to want to go. I have a sense that Legal Services, given that they have a social justice kind of mission, is not going to see that as a viable course of action. So, you know, where this ends up, it's going to be really interesting to see. But the one thing I do take away from it is that, and I've said this to people at Legal Services, it's like what is heartening to me is that you did something to change the narrative on this in a really powerful way. So win or lose, at least at this moment in time, in 2021, somebody stood up to these people and said, look, including the judge, Chico, you've lost your moral compass. You lost it a long time ago, and we're pointing that out to you right now. And so we as a community really need to take stock and look at how that happened, because there's blood on everybody's hands. We're all culpable for this, and that's something that's a whole subject in itself. But there's a culture in this community of tolerance of this. Well, I don't know. That might be a word you might have to bleep out. But anyway, yeah.
Well, look, let me just say something about my travels over the past few years have involved me living in Los Angeles, having traveled to Philadelphia, to Chicago, to San Francisco. And I get the impression from my many years in Chico and having stood many nights at the city council, before the city council in that chamber, which is a very unpleasant experience, and hearing person after person denigrate the homeless and talk about how, you know, people love to come to Chico because it's so easy for the homeless to live here. And my message in my coming back from my travels and looking at the destitution in Los Angeles and San Francisco, and people in Chico say, well, we don't want to be like San Francisco. And, you know, where there's people in the council a few years ago saying, I stepped in feces when I was in San Francisco, and I don't want Chico to be that way. And my observation, my message is that this is a massive systemic failure. There are at least 500,000 people who are unhoused any given night. And these homeless folk here in Chico are kind of the canaries in the coal mine. They are the products of a systemic failure, the products of a system that values individual success at the expense of civic duty and care for our fellow person. And so what I want to say is this is happening all around the country. And it's not simply that it's something that can be eliminated from, it cannot be eliminated from any of the communities until we all realize the systemic failure, until we all, we come together and acknowledge the housing shortage and we have a kind of housing first model. We do have just a couple of minutes and I want to go around. Cicery, Sherry, do you have any parting thoughts you want to share?
I would just like to remind everyone that on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at the Southwest corner of the plaza, we'll be serving coffee. Anyone's welcome to show up. We would love to see you bring stuff to share or just bring yourself.
Jana Burgess Henry, some final thoughts.
Well, I want to thank you for this opportunity to talk about these issues and, you know, shine a little light on what's going on legally. And also a big shout out to Legal Services of Northern California for their action and bringing something more to the conversation and something legal where we can all bite into. And I'm anxiously awaiting what the judge has to say in a couple of weeks.
Patrick Newman.
Thanks for having us, Robert. And thanks, Jana and Cicery, for joining in on this conversation. I'll just close with a little spiritual note, and that is that the information's in the suffering. Get closer to it, and it'll tell you a lot about what to do.
Thank you, Patrick Newman. Chico Friends on the Street can be reached at by email at chicofriendsonthestreet@gmail.com or on the web at chicofriendsonthestreet.org. Thank you to Patrick Newman, Cicery Sherry, Jana Burgess Henry for coming into the studio today. This has been the Peace and Social Justice Program. My name is Robert Jones. Stay tuned for Playing Dead at 1 o'clock.
Listen if you're missing, y'all. Swinging while I'm singing. Hey! Giving what you're getting. Knowing what I'm knowing. While the black band's sweating. In the rhythm I'm rolling. Got to give us what we want. Gotta give us what we need.
All right, thank you, Robert Jones. Good to hear you back on the radio, my friend. So was good. All righty, thanks for tuning in. I guess we got a minute or two early, so that's always good here on Playing Dead because, you know, we're always on the time restraint. And we're going to go back 33 years ago today to the beautiful, sunny, grassy knoll known as Frost Amphitheater on the Stanford University campus in Palo Alto, California. Talk about a hometown show. Jerry, of course, was born in San Francisco, but they all kind of came together in Palo Alto. Of course, Pigpen was from East Palo Alto, and Bobby was from Atherton. Good for Bobby. And Phil was from Berkeley, and he tagged along. Now he jumped across the there, and Billy was from Palo Alto as well. So the original core, and it all kind of went down in and around Palo Alto. If you've ever read any of the early books about the Grateful Dead, there's plenty of fun history to learn about. All righty, let's thank our underwriters and get right to today's program. We want to thank Affordable Automotive, repairing and maintaining all makes of cars, trucks, and SUVs since 1996. Affordable Automotive has pickup and delivery service with financing available at 2106 Park Avenue in Chico. Appointments available at 892-1774 and at chicoautomotive.com. And Affordable Automotive is looking for new technicians to join the team. You can call Mike Button at 892-1774. We also want to thank Dr. Ken Logan, family practitioner. Ken believes in the importance of community radio and encourages other members of the medical community to join the KZFR underwriting family. That's Ken Logan, family practitioner. Thank you, Mr. Logan, as always. All righty, let's get right to it. Fun, fun show. I put some nice pictures up on the Playing Dead on KZFR Facebook, and just the pictures of Jerry and Bobby and Phil and Brent, the smiles on this beautiful sunny afternoon on a Saturday, pretty much tells it all, and you'll hear it in the music. And I think I could pretty much get, we're going to get pretty much the whole show until probably the last three or four songs. So without further ado, let's let the good times roll.